Татарстан – один из регионов, который на фоне спада в
экономике. Рустама Миниханова, временно исполняющим обязанности главы Татарстана.
Государство отметило успехи Татарстана во всех сферах.
Полномочия Миниханова на посту главы Татарстана.
Однозначно поддерживаем линию президента Владимира
Путина. Острый конфликт, который происходит сейчас между...
Не главы Чечни Рамзана Кадырова сами.
Разыскных мероприятий в Чечне.
Рамзан Кадыров остановился на инциденте, произошедшем на...
Типичная история для Чечни.
Я человек Кремля. Знаешь, я человек Путина.
Two republics, both subjects of the Russian Federation, both predominantly Muslim, both seeking to secure maximum autonomy from Moscow, but each using dramatically different tactics. Tatarstan's leaders have focused on formal institutions. They have opened representative offices, de facto consulates abroad, and invited foreign governments to open consulates in Kazan. They are determined to keep the title of president for the republic's leader, and they are equally determined to defend Tatar language and culture. In contrast, Chechnya, under its eccentric strongman leader Ramzan Kadyrov, has expressed absolute loyalty and fealty to Moscow on formal and institutional matters. But in practice, Kadyrov has carved out a de facto statelet in the North Caucasus. He's threatened to have his security forces shoot Russian officers operating in his fiefdom without his permission. He's implicitly endorsed polygamy, and he's essentially privatized the regional branches of the FSB and Interior Ministry. What do the respective approaches of Kazan and Grozny and Moscow's reaction to them tell us about Russia today? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio is Rim Gilfanov, director of RFERL's Tatar Bashkir Service. Welcome back, Rim. Good to have you back on.
Nice to be with the audience, Brian.
And joining us on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the recently published book, Russia's Wars in Chechnya. Welcome back, Mark.
Good to be back, and good to see the Power Vertical back.
It's good to have the Power Vertical back, although I needed a little break. Well, as I noted in the intro, not only are Tatarstan's and Chechnya's approaches to securing autonomy different, but so are Moscow's respective responses. The Kremlin tends to lean hard on Tatarstan. Kadyrov, meanwhile, keeps getting awarded medals. He got another one today from Putin. I don't know how, I've lost count of how many medals the man has gotten in the last few months. Mark, what do you make of this contrast?
Well, I think it reflects a variety of factors, but in some ways, perhaps most importantly, I mean, clearly it reflects the fact that this was the devil's deal that Moscow made to end the war in Chechnya. They Chechenized it. They relied heavily on the Kadyrovtsi, the ex-guerrillas working for Ramzan. And frankly, by that stage, they were just so desperate that they were willing to basically give him autonomy and didn't, I think, fully appreciate just how far he was going to push it. And I think, therefore, they're now stuck with him. Particularly, I think, this increasing flow of medals. I mean, to me, it is much more like reminiscent of trying to placate the screaming toddler in the backseat of the car rather than any genuine respect for Kadyrov as a fine and upstanding supporter of the Russian state and its values. Whereas, I mean, Tatarstan is a grown-up in the sense of, you know, obviously it's a much more sort of viable sort of sub-state. I mean, its population is, what, almost three times that of Chechnya's. Its economy is, I mean, it's a real economy, unlike a pseudo-economy, a bandit economy that is Chechnya's. And Tatarstan, in a way, its ambitions have always been to be a sort of, you know, an autonomous but credible state within it. I mean, it's interesting that in January, Moody's downgraded the Republic of Tatarstan's sort of status. And what struck me was not that. I mean, that was no big deal. That was because of sort of, you know, fears of a default and so forth. But the very fact that Tatarstan is treated seriously. I mean, who would in any, you know, frankly, spend more than 4.8 seconds trying to come up with a rating for Chechnya? You know, the point is, I think this is the difference. Anyway, Tatarstan is a real state, and therefore it faces the problems that any kind of sub-state within a country like the Russian Federation, maybe we should have Russian quote Federation, unquote, is going to face. Chechnya, no one really pretends, is a real state. It's just a, how can we keep this basket case from overflowing?
But the result is that Chechnya gets to act like a real state. The worse Kadyrov behaves, the more medals he gets. He's threatened, and just in the past couple of weeks, he's threatened to shoot officers from other republics who are operating in law enforcement operations in Chechnya, including federal officers, if they come there without his permission. He's implicitly endorsed polygamy, for God's sakes. And we're not, and I'm not even beginning to talk about the all the stuff around the Nemtsov assassination, where suspicion is clearly pointing at him. But he just keeps getting medals and keeps getting more. So the result is, I mean, to stop Chechnya from becoming independent, Russia basically made it independent. No?
Yeah, but also, I mean, also what's happening is, in effect, Putin is finding that Kadyrov is pulling a Putin. If one looks at how Russia operates in the international scene, it is precisely, it is by making often outlandish threats. It's by going to, as it were, the civilized states and more or less sort of pushing its luck and saying, basically, well, what are you going to do? Putting the West in a position that it could obviously slap down Putin hard, but that would be problematic, confrontational, exactly the kind of things that actually the West doesn't want to do. Exactly. There's no question as to where real power lies. In objective terms, it is not with Russia. But the point is, in a way, Russia, because it's willing to break the rules, gets away with a lot, until someday it doesn't. Well, likewise, that's exactly what Kadyrov is doing in Chechnya. There is no question that power, real power, whether it's financial or military, rests with Moscow, not Grozny. But because Moscow is not willing to pay the price to do anything about it, so far at least, Kadyrov gets away with it. So there is a certain sort of karmic value in this.
Right, but in reality, in Grozny, real power rests with one man, and that man is Kadyrov. I mean, this is a man who padlocked the building of the FSB, locking everybody in it. If you remember, way back when he first came to power and he had a dispute with the local branch of the FSB, he wanted to show him who's boss, and he did. He locked them in the building. And so what use is this power if Moscow's not going to use it? If they don't use it, you don't have it.
Well, exactly, which is the same way, you know, this is precisely what Putin is counting on. I think that the bottom line is, look, what has Chechnya got that Moscow wants? Nothing. Nothing at all. All really Moscow wants from Chechnya is formal acquiescence, but above all, not being exploding into war. Because it's not as if there's any, there are great resources or other assets, frankly, within Chechnya that Moscow desperately needs. So, absolutely, Moscow has been willing to basically give Kadyrov Chechnya. In return for him not formally claiming it.
Formally.
And he's coming, exactly, but he is getting closer and closer. He is pushing his luck.
This is why I think that actually we
are beginning to come to the point where there are certainly people in Moscow who are beginning to think, at what point and how do we do something about the Kadyrov problem?
Now, switching to Tatarstan, I want to bring Rim into this. In contrast to this child in the back seat that you have to placate, as Mark wrote, Tatarstan, from the point of view of inside the Russian Federation, is a good subject of the Federation. It's a good citizen. It's a net contributor to the budget, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm pretty sure it is.
It's a donor.
It's a net donor to the budget. It's not talking about becoming independent. There isn't any threat of an insurgency in Tatarstan. It's basically, but yet it gets nothing but grief from Moscow. Rim, how do you? You've been listening to Mark and I talk about this. How do you react to this contrast in the way these two republics are treated and how they behave?
Well, I think that the behavior of Tatarstan is mainly defined by its geopolitics, its enclave, first of all. And geography means a lot in this, even in modern world. So it's surrounded by Russian regions, so Tatarstan has no access to other countries. Yeah. So in this case, Tatarstan has to behave slightly differently. The second factor is the population and the Russian factor in Tatarstan itself, because half of the population actually Russian, and there is a big chunk of Tatars speaking only Russian. And given the latest events with Ukraine, around Ukraine, the mentality became sort of, again, pro-Kremlin, pro-Russian. Mm-hmm. So in this environment, Tatarstan leadership, first of all, President Minikhanov, they have to behave differently But at the same time, they are really, you were right, they are really fighting for symbols. They think that in some time in the future, this will help to regain actually the more autonomy for Russia. You know, in general, Russia is a country of symbols, you know, and they are fighting more for symbols for for the reality, real content. So if you remember the history, Russian Tsars, they till the 1917, they carry the title Tsar Kazansky.
Mm-hmm.
So formally, the Kazan Khanate as a Tatar state was still existing, yeah, as a part of empire, but still the title was there. So this comes from history as well.
Now, why this? I mean, I understand that Russia is a country of symbols, but why this focus so much on institutions? I mean, right now the deadline for Tatarstan giving up the title of president is coming up, and President Medvedev.
It was extended, by the way.
It's extended to when?
Well, it was extended for 1 year,
and the deadline is approaching soon.
Approaching, yeah, by the end of the year,
the end of this year. Now, why is this so important to Tatarstan, to keeping the title of president? Why has that become such a rallying point when at the end of the day, it's really meaningless in terms of real power? Kadyrov doesn't have the title of president. He has the title of regional head, and he basically runs his country like as if he were a head of state. What is the importance of this?
Well, these two cases are really different. I mean, if Kadyrov builds, in fact, actually independent state, mm-hmm, Tatarstan fighting for symbols, for formal signs of sovereignty as presidency, as flag, as a parliament, as state languages. You know, I think in the case of Tatarstan, it's like because all the other fields were already lost.
Yeah.
So they are now on the last positions, defending their uniqueness, mm-hmm, ethnic uniqueness. So in this situation, symbols are becoming really very, very substantial thing.
There's something. I was trying to provoke you a little bit, but it didn't work. So I'm going to try again. We were talking off mic a few weeks back when we originally got the idea to do this podcast, if you remember, and you were raising the issue of Tatarstan opening representative offices abroad, and it was you, me, and Aslan Dokhayev, who the director of our North Caucasus service, who I wish could be with us today, but is unfortunately unable to. But Aslan made a really good point. He said, you know, this is really interesting because Tatarstan is basically building up the infrastructure of a state that if ever things really go bad in Russia, Tatarstan could basically pick up and have this infrastructure in place. Mm-hmm. It could operate. I mean, imagine, you know, a crazy scenario where everything collapses around it. It could be a viable state. Is that in the thinking of the leadership, do you think?
Theoretically, yes. You know, you were asking about the presidency, so that's why I'm asking about presidency. But just going further, yes, Tatarstan moved this fighting for autonomy to mostly to economics, mm-hmm, to this financial, mm-hmm, field.
Control of the oil revenues from Tatneft.
Yes, yeah, Tatneft still, it's not bought by any Russian company. So where they actually strong attempts to swallow by Rosneft, by Yevtushenko's.
Is it controlled by Tatars who are close, who are considered?
It's like it's private company, but controlled by Tatarstan government because president himself is a head of.
Well, that's important. In Russia, he who controls the oil has power.
I think there is an agreement between Putin and Minikhanov and Shaimiev that because Tatneft is a main contributor for Tatarstan budget.
Mm-hmm.
So just to keep the, as they call it, stability in this important region. So they agreed somehow that Tatarstan will pay federal taxes, but at the same time, he has to retain some assets, you know, mm-hmm, to provide this financial backing.
Now, Sechin would love to get his hands on that for Rosneft, to be sure.
there were attempts, yeah, to take it over, but so far Tatarstan leadership opposed it. So returning back to this economic ties, Tatarstan leaders could manage somehow to make a deal with Moscow that it's necessary to keep the region loyal to Moscow. So that's why they are pretty much engaged in all federal projects, in this investment projects, attracting money from outside, from foreign countries.
Is that the main goal of the foreign representative offices, or is that a symbolic thing? Is that an institution-building thing?
In some places they are symbolic, but in some places they do real work. I mean, with Turkey, for example, or in Czech Republic here. Or they try now with China. So given the Russian turn to China now, to the East, they try to use any opportunity to go with Russian line, but at the same time to provide some, you know, local interest there as well.
Right. Mark, I wanted to bring you in on this. You've been listening to Rim and I here as he was listening to you and I. What are your thoughts here? I know Tatarstan's not your main area of focus, but you I'm sure you have some thoughts about this because you always do.
I may have no thoughts, but I'm always willing to talk. I think the interesting thing about Tatarstan is precisely it is in its own way a essentially viable sub-state. And maybe perhaps because of sort of being British, you know, I've been thinking about Scotland. in a way, the interesting thing is that these are both states that have high levels of interconnectivity. You know, a lot of the people who live in Scotland are English rather than Scots. But nonetheless, quite a few of those, when it came down to it, actually see their interests as more, that they think that actually an independent Scotland might well actually represent those interests more. You know, ultimately, the independence vote went narrowly against it, but who knows quite what's going to happen, especially with other developments. But also the thing about is that Scotland has got certain key assets, again, like Tatarstan, there's North Sea oil, or in this case, I mean, Tatarstan has got oil, but it also has industry. I mean, it's got Kamaz trucks, it's got Kazan helicopters and so forth. And so for me, the interesting thing is you actually have this interconnectivity of the symbolic value of the title of president and so forth, which is a way of feeling a certain pride and identity. Also, holding on to it is symbolic of actually holding on to the successes that were made, particularly in the 90s, about acquiring autonomy and trying to say we want to hold on to it. But there's also the fact that actually it contributes to its economic value. I mean, this is the thing that strikes me, is that precisely you have Tatarstan essentially almost on a national level with its representative offices, with its sort of, you know, foreign delegations and such like. You hear about Tatarstan a lot more than you do most Russian regions. And I think the fact of actually almost being not just another Russian region, but actually this specific, cohesive, element with its own identity is also an advantage for its economic diplomacy. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think these things actually all interconnect. And I think it's not just simply a sort of a sentimental factor. It means that 40% or whatever it is who are Slavic within Tatarstan and the other, whatever it is, 7% who are non-Tatars, actually they themselves have an innate reason to want to see this. This is not an ethnic Tatar cause. This is a citizens of Tatarstan cause. So, I mean, I think it's interesting the way these things all connect.
Yeah, it's mostly for local identity and a sub-identity, I would
say. Does that identity extend to local Russians?
Yes, in some extent, yes. And that's why the current president tries to make the region, Kazan, more attractive so the people could unite, you know, feel some attachment, personal attachment being with Tatarstan, with Kazan now, given this Universiade Games, different championships, some successes in sports with the hockey team, football team. So the people start thinking on something different, that there is Russia something, there is Sakhalin or, you know, Kostroma, and there is Tatarstan, which Kazan actually became pretty much attractive city now. I mean, a lot of tourists are coming. And
this is something I wanted to make note of, because I, as you know, I lived in Tatarstan in 1991. It was actually the first Russian city I ever lived in. I was in Kazan before I was in Moscow, or in St. Petersburg. And the thing that struck me in this, again, was immediately after the failed putsch of August 91 is when I arrived. I arrived in Tatarstan, I believe it was the 1st of September, 1991. And what struck me was how bleak it was at the time. And you remember, you were there. In fact, we were studying at the same university and we didn't even know each other. But we had the same professor. but anyway, it struck me Kazan was bleak. I mean, it was in that time. It was a center of organized crime. It was considered one of the most dangerous cities in Russia. The mafia was quite strong there. Mark could probably speak to that quite eloquently. And I've not been back to Kazan since. But every time I look at video footage or photos, I'm just blown away. And I don't know. I mean, I know every place in Russia, things have gotten a lot better than they were at that time because that was pretty much the low point. But I haven't seen statistics, but Kazan and Tatarstan have probably progressed more than other Russian regions, no?
Except Moscow, probably. Except Moscow. Because Moscow gets all the money. But they now position themselves as a third capital of Russia. So it's mostly for tourists getting more, not only foreign, but for internal, yeah. I mean, from inside the Russia. And it's even more actual thing now because, you know, given the latest crisis, not many people can afford going outside.
Mm-hmm.
So many people started to look for possibilities inside the country, and many people are coming to Kazan. At the same time, we continuing again talking about these representatives. Tatarstan not only opens its representatives outside, but tries to get foreign consulates in Kazan, and it's also important because in Soviet times, Kazan had nothing actually, no foreign representation at all. And even the first years of Yeltsin presidency, and only Turkish consulate was opened at the end of 90s. Then it was joined by Iranian, Kazakhstan, mm-hmm. Belarusian, and now, ago, this year, Hungarians opened consulate in Kazan. And this is also shows and illustrates how Minikhanov tries to use the opportunity, because now Russia has very good relations with Orban, with Hungary. So Moscow cannot oppose anything connected with Hungary. So Tatars again use this opportunity and opened additional.
Well, it's interesting. Similarly with Turkey, Moscow enjoys very good relations with Ankara, and so they're going to hardly oppose a Turkish consulate or a Tatar representative office in Turkey. But it's not just consulates; it's foreign dignitaries too. If I'm not mistaken, Hillary Clinton made a stopover when she was Secretary of State during a visit.
Yes,
it was back in 2010, 2009. I forget which.
There was even a joke that because of that, Shaimiev actually was stripped of his presidency. That's why.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So Russians didn't like the American interest in Tatarstan.
You mentioned Shaimiev, and I want to use that just to get at something. Because what are the different approaches between Rustam Minnikhanov and Mitamir Shaimiev, the two presidents of Tatarstan after independence? Shaimiev, how have they approached this issue differently?
Times were different. That's why now it was like their behavior was actually determined by the situation in Moscow. So during Yeltsin times, it was really not that hard to get some autonomy and defend it. But for Minikhanov, it's much harsher. You know, now we have Russian state. Not it's formally federation, but in fact, actually, it's like old empire.
It's a centralized.
Very much centralized
vertical,
state.
Vertically integrated state.
Yes, and in this, so that's why Minikhanov has chosen this economic aspect, you know, trying to get more investments, economics, and doing this, keep the, you know, this autonomy, at least formally autonomy.
But both are similar in terms of their desire to preserve as much Tatar autonomy as they could, right? Or is one more conciliatory?
Yes, but I don't think it's because of their goodwill, but just the reality dictates, because their local elite cannot exist otherwise.
Mm.
They are based on this distinct activity, let's say.
Is it possible that Moscow could put somebody in there that's going to be, you know, basically a Moscow Quisling, if you would. Moscow
can try everything. I mean, they tried it with Kyiv as well. So, but at the same time, I think there is understanding in Kremlin that Tatarstan is not like Chechnya. It's a donor region. So, by the way, 2 days ago, Minikhanov met with local journalists, and he said that they paid 750 billion rubles taxes to Moscow, to federal center last year, given that the local budget, Tatarstan's budget, is 250, meaning taxes will be paid three times more than the local budget.
That's interesting.
So Moscow can try whatever it wants, but at the same time, Moscow, I think, is not interested in losing that, you know, the stable region, which provides federal budget.
But they could continue to get that money to the federal budget if they put their man in there. They, that was going to be completely.
They
loyal.
Try to control the leadership of Tatarstan by, you know, working with Russian community, different anti, you know, if Tatarstan shows some signs of getting too independent, they immediately representatives of Russian community are, you know,
starting
now.
Trouble. I mean, yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, actually, I would sort of push back slightly on this idea that this is some kind of centralized empire. I think we have to appreciate the extent to which the federationness of the Russian Federation isn't a complete fiction. Yes, when it comes down to it, obviously, sort of, you know, the center matters. And certainly this is far, far more centralized than during Boris Yeltsin. But that's a little bit like saying someone is more sober than Boris Yeltsin. It may well be true, but doesn't necessarily mean all that much. You know, we see that Moscow actually always has to find some way of working with local elites. And it doesn't, I mean, obviously, and it becomes particularly a factor where you have a strong local non-Russian ethnicity. Where you have to sort of consider, you know, how is this going to play with them, the Tatars or the Dagestanis or whatever. But even, I mean, if you look at the maritime region, you know, in the Far East, actually the relationship, you know, Moscow often has quite a difficult relationship.
Primorsky Krai, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. And even when it does sort of parachute in its own people, actually they have to an extent, go native, just simply in order to work with the local elites. So, I mean, I think actually there is a lot more complexity in the center-periphery relationship. And the very fact that actually all the regions, Yakutia, Kemerovo, wherever, they have their representative offices in Moscow. In a way, they have their own little embassies there. Mm. So I think the thing is...
But not abroad, like Tatarstan.
Well, no, not abroad, though you do have some kind of trade missions and such like. But yeah, but I mean, the thing is, Tatarstan is, as it were, at one extreme end of the spectrum.
Well, I'd say Chechnya is the ultra-extreme end of the spectrum, but...
Well, I mean, I think we're going to make it into a triangle in some ways. But anyway, never mind. But the point is, I mean, you know, it's sort of... Tatarstan is probably about as pseudo-state as you can go within the Russian Federation. You know, and it's trying to hold on to that the element. But... That doesn't necessarily mean that the alternative is just simply to be a mindless drone of Moscow. Mm. Even if they manage to sort of take away some of these symbolic and political status of Tatarstan, the very fact precisely that Tatarstan has assets, the very fact that Tatarstan is not economically dependent, you know, and actually has quite a strong identity, is going to give it quite a certain amount of bargaining weight within the system. But of course, again, there's these two different sort of models of the Tatar and the Chechen. You know, the Chechen one is quite the opposite. It's more or less, look, you have to keep bankrolling us. You have to keep indulging us. Otherwise, terrible, you know, we'll just collapse and terrible things will happen. Mm-hmm. No one is saying that Tatarstan, you know, if our boss isn't called a president, there is going to be anarchy in the streets. Of course not. I mean, you know, Tatarstan's problem is that it works so well. Mm. You know, that is actually the terrible paradox. There is a power in being a hapless, sort of miserable place. You know, and likewise, I mean, Grozny has been transformed even more so than Kazan, arguably.
Right.
But firstly, no one wants to go there. Even if they want to go there, they probably can't go there. And the point is that the day that federal subsidies stop is the day that those shiny empty tower blocks start collapsing.
And whereas if, you know, Tatarstan could exist without one ruble from federal from the federal center, right? It can exist on what it produces.
Well, I mean, I just say
yeah, it's better off.
Yeah. It'd be actually be better off. Yeah. Before we move into the next section, I wanted to just address one. We're going to return to Kadyrov, but and talk about how far can he go in what he's doing, and Tatarstan, how far can it go in what it's doing, and how sustainable is each approach? Do you have any thoughts on that, Mark?
Well, I mean, I'll let Rim talk more about Tatarstan, though. You know, were I advising Putin, I'd be saying, just let the Tatars do their stuff, you know, just leave them be. I think that's eminently sustainable. I mean, in a way, the question there is how far Moscow ends up messing with Tatarstan's sort of prospects for progress. But going on to Chechnya, I mean, how sustainable is it? Well, again, it's this awful sort of thing of it's sustainable until the point where it's not. It's sustainable until the time when actually Moscow says, oh, for God's sake, we have to do something about
this. Well, they haven't done that yet, for God's sakes. When are they going to do it? I mean,
well, yeah, but I mean, I was commissioning
hits in the center of Moscow, endorsing polygamy, threatening to shoot federal officers in Chechnya. This is what I mean. How far can this man go?
Well, I think the thing is, there is, and to be honest, I think an exaggerated, but nonetheless a very real fear within Moscow government circles that actually turning against Kadyrov would basically bring absolute anarchy to the streets of Chechnya. And it's an element of Orientalism. There's an element in which actually they, you know, raised on not just stories of the Chechen wars, but, you know, going back into the Russian classics, the sense of the Chechen as the implacable, blood feud motivated sort of bandit, and the sense that these 20,000 Kadyrovtsi with their personal oath to Kadyrov would fight to the death in his name or whatever.
A lot of that is a myth, though.
Absolutely, absolutely. Nothing else. You can remember that the Kadyrovtsi are mostly ex-guerrillas, or certainly their old core. In other words, they've already changed sides once. So why one should assume that they'd be averse to changing sides another one is another matter. But anyway, the point is, you know, even if I don't buy it, I think it is a genuine belief
by
a lot
of
people within the sort of security and close to security apparatus, you know, within Moscow, that actually moving against Kadyrov would basically mean that the Kadyrovtsi either would just disappear or would actually become anti-government forces, and that suddenly they'd find themselves with another Chechen war. And particularly at the moment, with basically the lion's share of their operational high-quality forces being deployed to Ukraine, and the rest, frankly, being busy in just regrouping after deployments. I mean, because basically all their paratroop divisions are essentially having to cycle forces in and out of Ukraine and then regroup afterwards. They're not really, there's no appetite for another Chechen war. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, and I think this is it. I think sort of Kadyrov appreciates that. And Kadyrov is smart and dumb in equal sort of quantities. I mean, he's wily enough to realize that and know that he has leverage at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, being Kadyrov, he's pushing it. But I think he's dumb in the sense of not appreciating the limits of that. And I think this is it. I mean, just as in a way one could argue that Putin on the global scene has actually dramatically overstepped the mark and is bringing about, you know, his and Russia's, if not downfall, but certainly pain. Even though on the ground it looks as if he's victorious in the sense of, you know, Ukraine is still at war, the West is still agonizing and so forth. Well, so too, I mean, I think Kadyrov has reached that point where precisely, I mean, you know, the bridges have not just been burned, they've been positively napalmed. Mm-hmm. There are so many people who actually regard him as a threat and as a negative thing. Putin maybe, but I can't find anyone or think of anyone who I think actually has a positive approach to Kadyrov.
Except Putin, and he's the one that counts.
Well, we assume Putin. I mean, this is a problem. None of us know what Putin
is. Although if it's not Putin that's protecting him after all this, who could it possibly be?
Well, it's not, I think, protection. I mean, I think it is. I mean, even the FSB, I mean, you know, the FSB clearly you know, loathe and despise him, and were happy with the Nemtsov assassination to basically use that to stir the waters. Likewise, I mean, the investigations committee, especially, I mean, 2013, Sergei Bobrov, their guy there had to be pulled back because he started to receive death threats when he started to investigate some murder cases that were clearly connected to the regime. All the power apparatuses don't like him, but I don't – even they, I think, are very hesitant. Mm-hmm. About anything that they think might bring anarchy back. I mean, the anarchy, the sort of anarchy that they're having to deal with, the odd assassination, you know, these are things that I think they think are bearable in at the moment, at least.
What does he have to do? Burn down the Kremlin?
one does wonder. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I mean, Nemtsov assassination, yeah, that was deeply embarrassing and problematic. Probably not, well, it's certainly not Kadyrov's first assassination in Moscow. But they live with it. But this is it. I think at the moment, embroiled as they are in Ukraine, there is no way they are going to do anything which they feel would lead to a new conflagration in the North Caucasus. So in some ways, Kadyrov should be hoping that actually this conflict doesn't end. Mm. Because if it does end, that's the point where all of a sudden people might start thinking, okay, maybe now's the time.
So one of the consequences of ending the Chechen war might be that they actually do move on Kadyrov. Ukrainian war, exactly. Rim, same question with Tatarstan, unless you want to add something.
Yeah, I would like to add about the Chechen, my outsider's view. You know, Kadyrov is mostly engaged in this internal fighting in Kremlin. You know, it's not like contradictions between super state Russia and sub state Chechnya. Yeah. So Kadyrov is mostly fighting with FSB, and he's backed by this Kremlin bodyguards service. So it's not like Russian Chechnya or...
And Kadyrov regularly, if you look at the power rankings of Russian politicians, he regularly is in the top group.
And even this, you know, his order to shoot federals, it was directed mostly against FSB and internal affairs, you know, ministry. So it's not like against Russians,
it was against federal law enforcement or law enforcement from other regions.
So in case of Tatarstan, I don't expect that Tatarstan leadership will do something extra now. The main aim for them is to keep the situation as calm as possible, to keep this stability. So in case the things in Russian state are getting worse, they could easily come up, you know, pop up as a functioning structure.
Right.
So that's why they try to talk less. And the main thing for them is just to defend the remaining position.
Defend what they have, keep these institutions in place, and they're there, they'll be there when they need them. All right. Well, in a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at the repercussions of the conflict in Ukraine for ethnic minorities in Russia. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me in the studio is Rim Gilfanov, director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service. And joining us on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the recently published book, Russia's Wars in Chechnya. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Поэтому федерализация – это путь к тому, чтобы каждый регион чувствовал.
Путь федерализации, децентрализации или...
Наше предложение неприемлемо, потому что федерализация, убеждены, что только через федерализацию это можно сделать эффективно.
Это можно назвать федерализацией, можно назвать децентрализацией, можно еще придумать, там есть английские термины, devolution, например.
Russian officials love to talk about federalization and local autonomy, as long as we're talking about Ukraine. But as soon as these words are applied to Russia, the Kremlin cries treason. Rim, we were talking off mic this past week about the effect the Ukraine crisis might have on ethnic minorities in Russia, on minority languages in Russia, and I know you're pretty concerned about this, if I recall our conversation. What are your worries?
Well, you know, this Novorossiya project started in Kremlin. Looks like it's getting to its end now. So I think that Russia will do everything to keep the instability in Donbass. It's usual Moscow's policy to keep these frozen conflicts around, just to control the neighboring countries. So in this sense, I'm not that optimistic, though the scale of the engagement will be probably going too slow. But at the same time, it means pretty harsh reality for minorities inside the country. Because in Kremlin, and I think Putin himself, as a KGB guy who represents all this imperial, this chauvinistic views in Russian leadership, they came to conclusion that all minorities, all ethnic distinctions, religious distinctions, they are posing threat to the Russian state stability, Russian state existence at all. So, formally,
and you think this is going to be accentuated by the failure to get what they wanted in Ukraine?
Yes. That's why, you know, why they are talking about the federalization in Ukraine, because they think they really it shows their thinking that this making this you know
making this, Ukraine federalized to stabilize it, right?
That's their tool to keep Ukraine in control. It makes a federal. I mean, putting you know separating Russians from Ukrainian nation. So. And inside the country, they will try to make it impossible. So, meaning, I expect they put more pressure on languages.
Well, we were already seeing pressure on languages. Yeah, on there's minorities. New measures about language education that
because
were just
the
passed.
Aim is to get the Russian society as much homogeneous as possible, to make one-minded, one language, one set of values. So. Preferably one religion, but it's not easy, you know.
It seems to me, though, they've been doing that for centuries, and we still have... I mean, it is a country that is, we must not forget, is 85% ethnic Russian, the Russian Federation is. But you still have... But it's a very big country, and you have a very large in numbers Tatar minority.
And minorities are not immigrants. I mean, they usually... They're
indigenous.
Indigenous people on their territory, so it's not, I mean, easy to... But nevertheless, I see new wave of, you know, Russification now in the country.
Mm-hmm. Mark, would you agree with that? What do you think the effect of the Ukraine crisis is going to be on minorities in Russia?
I think I'd be a little bit more cautious about sort of two aspects of that. I mean, one is, I mean, the Russians are not fools. They are able to be subtle in their policy. I think although absolutely with Ukraine they see federalization as being destabilization, I'd agree with you there. I don't necessarily think that they think in every case any form of devolution equals weak governance. I think they're able to sort of balance that. And it's quite interesting that one of the very few measures, you know, it's a time when, frankly, policy has largely been in autopilot this year, apart from in terms of destabilizing neighboring countries. One of the actual measures we have seen is the creation of this new federal agency for ethnic affairs. This spring was created under Igor Barinov, who's, interestingly enough, an ex-colonel in the FSB, because after all, if one looks for delicacy and sort of an accepting nature, one always looks to the Federal Security Service, and a former sort of Alpha Squad sort of commando and that kind of thing. But very much the task of this was basically to explicitly to improve the unity of a multi-ethnic nation. I think there is a recognition that there's no point in trying to enforce Russification on the country as a whole, especially when it comes to orthodoxy and the, sort of those, the real sort of core Russian culture, ethnic Russian cultural values. I mean, I think this is seen as two things. One is a purely political issue. how do we actually manage the country better? And I think there is an awareness also that actually many of the obstacles to the power vertical are nothing to do with ethnicity, but just local elites who may well be Slavs, who just simply are corrupt, inefficient, looking after their own interests and such like. And I think there is a renewed drive to try and improve the administration of the country and, by definition, improve the extent to which they obey Moscow's writ. And in a way, the ethnic issue is just one strand in that, but there's many others. But the other one is still this struggle for, well, what is Russia? And I think the interesting thing about the sort of like the St. George's ribbon and the whole pageantry around Victory Day is that on the one hand, we might think of it as a Russian thing, hey, it's St. George or whatever. But there were a lot of efforts, I think, to make it clear that this is an inclusive celebration. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I mean, the symbolism of Sergei Shoigu crossing himself at the start of the parade as he sort of walked under the icon. No one is suggesting for a minute that Sergei Shoigu, to even Buddhist by all accounts, has suddenly become a Russian Orthodox mm-hmm. believer. But the point is, it's that in a way, he, while still being himself, he also could show respect for ethnic Russian cultural values and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it's a little bit more complex, and I'm getting far too theoretical here. Mm-hmm.
No, that's fine.
I mean, it's actually that they're still struggling, still after all these years, struggling to answer that most fundamental question of what is Russia? Mm. And I think it's still one of these areas where there is dispute. There really are people who do want to see genuine kind of old-style Russification. And then there are people who actually are sort of still trying to find some way in which you can tell people, whether they're Tatars or Chuvash or whatever, actually, you know, Russia offers you something. You can be a good, loyal, and content Russian citizen, even while not going to church and speaking Russian at home and whatever else. But the business of the Russian language, I mean, I think that's particularly an administrative thing.
Well, there are signs, though, to support what Rim was saying, that there is a renewed push towards Russification. There's these new measures on language education, which, Rim, you could speak to this much more eloquently than I can, that a lot of people in places like Tatarstan fear are gonna squeeze the Tatar language out of the schools, if I'm not mistaken. What about that?
They don't talk about it openly, but think is that the new Russification is underway anyway. So I can just try to prove it on several cases. Like, first of all, in with Tatars, for example, there has been an attempt to create Tatar National University for years. University is different. It's not like normal school. It's not like even high school. It's university. It's like an academy, actually. So it wasn't the permission wasn't given by Moscow. This question of Tatar alphabet, the Tatarstan wanted to switch to Latin because it's more suitable for Turkic languages. Everything was prepared. The law was adopted in Tatarstan, but Russian State Duma ruled that state languages in ethnic republics cannot be based on Cyrillic. So it could, again, you know, if Tatars switch to Latin, it could, you know, put another distinction, you know, that they are different. But Russians decided not. I mean, they are violating, as they said, common cultural space. So it was banned. Now we are coming to unified school exams. They had to be only in Russian now. So this, you know, this feeling that speaking Tatar is sort of handicap is being put mm-hmm. on child's level, you know. That's why it's already sort of, you know, shows the attitude of federal government to this, to languages, to minority languages.
Rim, isn't this more Moscow pushing back against an attempted Tatarification? I mean, it's a little bit like if Brighton Beach suddenly said, well, we'd like to go into Cyrillic. And New York State saying, actually, this wouldn't. Well, yeah, but New York State might think no. I mean, look, I mean, and I'm not trying to here to be Moscow's advocate, but I mean, I think the thing is exactly, it really would create a variety of problems on a federal level if you start actually having individual republics deciding which alphabet they're going to use and everything else. And likewise, you know, the same way as, you know, I expect my students in New York to write their exams in English. You know, I mean, rather than say Spanish,
no,
or whatever. I think a lot of countries have
Mark,
to grapple
I think,
with this.
I think that in Brooklyn they still use Cyrillic, not Latin letters, right? In Russian shops there, so
yeah.
So Russians in Brooklyn, they didn't switch to Latin because they are living in the United States, I think. And the second thing, during Soviet times, government had no problem with Georgians, with Armenians, who use their own letters with Baltic states. So it's actually artificial problem. It's not the
well. There you might have hit on something there, Rim, because maybe they're afraid of Tatarstan becoming something like a union republic. And you know where all the union republics of the USSR went when the thing collapsed.
I was talking about it that because it creates sort of and again the Tatars are different. They are not like they are again another sign of being different from Russian nation. And it's not going with their new attempt to create new political nation called Rossiyani. So everything should be common. Identity, mentality, language, habits. Mm-hmm. So in this, they are trying to get everything the same.
Right. We're also coming up on, speaking of republics, the anniversary of the creation of the Tatar Autonomous Republic, if I'm not mistaken. Rim, are we not? It's coming up soon, right?
Yeah, it's 25th of May.
25th of May.
Yeah.
What year? It was created in, under Stalin.
1920, yeah.
1920.
But again, it was, again, like it's artificial project.
So it's the 95th.
There was a real, genuine attempt to create the Tatar-Bashkir state, Idel Ural, so-called Idel Ural. Immediately after the February Revolution.
Mm-hmm. After the First World War, yeah.
Yeah, it was declared already in Ufa. But Bolsheviks came out just to destroy the idea. They first provided autonomy to Bashkir separately. Mm-hmm. And then in 2 years, Tatarskaya ISSR was created on a very shrinked, you know, territory.
So the irony is that this was the creation of the Tatar SSR was a attempt to prevent Tatar.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the territory was really small. I mean, that's why only 25% of Tatars living in Tatarstan now. The big chunk of the nation is surrounding regions or in Central Asia. So I think, well, I don't agree with Mark in this. I think this Russification is pretty much underway.
Mark, last word to you before we wrap it up.
Well, I mean, again, I think we have to think about the difference between sort of practical administrative Russification, in other words, having a single common language and such like, and sort of standardized testing and whatever else, and actually attempts to impose Russian culture. Fortunately, I'm more optimistic on the latter. I don't think that Moscow actually wants to try and do that. I think that Moscow wants to stop places like Tatarstan precisely going further in creating themselves into small states. And in that respect, again, I mean, Kadyrov in so many ways exercises a baleful influence. They're aware of the extent to which they're now stuck with this pseudo-state of Chechnya. And therefore, I think they have a very, very negative idea of what happens when you allow the locals to take control.
Although, in fairness, Moscow helped create that situation in Chechnya, let's face it.
Oh, absolutely. But, I mean, I have every belief that they had no idea how far it was going to go. They saw this as essentially a war-winning strategy, a Chechenization. And I don't think they really thought through. They were just desperate.
But I even mean with launching the first Chechen war back in 94. I mean, it's not like the Chechnya just erupted and Moscow had to do something about it. Moscow had a hand in Chechnya erupting.
Well, I mean, this was such a sort of a combined, you know, everyone conspired to ensure that Chechnya was going to be an absolute mess. Because obviously, yes, the Chechens took the opportunity when Yeltsin said, basically, take as much autonomy as you can swallow. And they said, well, thank you very much. Actually, we've always hated you deeply and with a passion. And therefore, we will essentially become independent. And that's the point when Yeltsin said, well, actually, you know what I said? I didn't actually mean it. But the thing is also at the same time, I mean, Dudayev's Chechnya was thoroughly unpleasant, criminalized sort of place. I mean, this is terrible. Unfortunately, this was a conflict in which there were really no good guys. And since then, I mean, you know, obviously, when it comes down to it, this is one of these reasons
except the
why
civilians who are
empires are bad things. You know, so don't try this at home, kids, because they never sort of tend to end nicely. But the thing is about Chechnya. I mean, in a way, there is a certain inexorable logic. Once the wars had started, Moscow could not lose. It could not be seen to lose. Again, in this way, it's a little bit like Ukraine now. You know, you feed your tie into the machine, well, it's going to keep shredding. So actually, Moscow had to therefore win that war however it could. And it thought wrongly that this was the way this was the most efficient way of winning the war. And what they did is they won the war but lost the peace as a result. But now they're stuck with their creature Kadyrov.
And as a result, they don't want to give anybody else that kind of autonomy? Is that where...
I think, yeah, I mean, not that I think they believe that actually, you know, sort of let the Tatars use their own language and next thing Mikhailov will be having people whacked in the streets of Moscow. I mean, there's not a direct parallel, but I think it does speak to this sort of centralizing impulse.
There is another aspect in this, because Moscow really is afraid of if any sort of, you know, uniqueness appears in some region, the foreign forces start working with them just to destroy the Russian country. It's on the level of, you know, history already.
Yeah,
you know.
It's just paranoia, yes, which is not based
what
in reality.
Was talking about when she was there.
Right. No, I mean, no. To wrap it up, I mean, what I think Tatarstan is doing is trying to create the attributes of a union republic of the USSR, basically, within the Russian Federation.
Yeah,
these
it was a long
exist.
Time, the dream of Tatar activists.
During Soviet times, to be
to
a
become,
union republic.
Not become an independent, but become a union state.
Right.
Just
one
to
of
have
the same
right.
Would have been the 16th republic of the USSR, yes, and then when the USSR broke up, they would have been independent like everybody else, but because they were an autonomous republic within the RSFSR, the Russian Federation, they didn't. And now they seem to be trying to create something akin to or a parallel of union republic type status within the Russian Federation if one day in the future... Who knows? You know, so they'll be ready with. And Moscow, I think, is trying to prevent this for the exact same reasons. Right?
But at the same time, it has to tolerate it because of the reality. Because, as I said, it also interested in some sort of stability in the region. So Moscow is afraid of getting another problematic region. So it's actually in disarray. I mean, whether to pursue, you know, this imperial and to suppress everything or to try to work with local elite.
And it seems to vacillate back and forth. I mean, really, like I said at the outset, looking at these two situations in Tatarstan and Chechnya, as different as they are, they tell us a lot about the state of the Russian Federation today. And that's unfortunately all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been Rim Gilfanov, director of RFRL's Tatar Bashkir service. And joining us on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russia's security services, and author of the recently published book, Russia's Wars in Chechnya. Thank you both for an enlightening and lively and fun discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.